We started looking at Ecclesiastes last Sunday evening, and we took an overview of the whole book. We spent time working out who wrote it, which we said is Solomon, and when he wrote it, which we reckoned was at the end of his life, after his period of apostasy or near apostasy and backsliding. We thought about who he wrote it to. It's not got a lot of Jewish references here. We thought that he probably wrote it to the whole of his empire, which stretched far beyond Israel. There's no mention of Yahweh in the whole book, no Jewish history, no mention of the Torah, the law. It's something which is very much aimed at a Gentile and a Jewish audience. And we tried to get a feel for the book. We questioned whether or not the word meaningless or vanity really gets across the full impact of what Solomon's saying when he says hebel hebelim, all is hebel. And we saw that the Hebrew word probably means breath or vapor or mist, and so we'd want at least to have the idea of transience, of temporality in our thinking when we hit all the vanities of the book. If there is a thing that makes life seem so empty and pointless, one of them is that it is so short. And if we get to the end of it thinking, well, was that all that there was? Then it is depressing. And it does seem futile. Then we also took an overview of the first sermon in the book. We're arguing that there are four sermons in Ecclesiastes, the first one being chapters 1 and 2. And following all of the recent evangelical scholars, we've reckoned that our translation of the conclusion from verse 24 to 26 is not totally helpful and is somewhat misleading. And if you read Leupold, Stuart Olliott, Walter Kaiser, you get hopefully this sort of translation, which is, I think, much better. Verse 24 doesn't fizzle out with a hopeless, there is nothing better for a person to do than that he should eat, drink, and find enjoyment in all his toil. That's exactly what Solomon's been saying through chapters 1 and 2. Is he going to say this is the best we can do? And in the Hebrew, if you look at what you've got in the NIV and all the other versions and then what we've got up here, you'll see that we haven't got a comparison on the screen. And there isn't a comparison in the Hebrew, a better than, the Hebrew word min. I can see why the translators have put one in, or thought that there ought to be one, because there is one in chapter 3, verse 12. There's nothing better for a man to do than this. And there is also one in chapter 8. And they've assumed that because we've got a similar phrase, but without the comparison here, it's dropped out. We've lost a min. And so they've popped them in back in. But what if Solomon didn't want one there? And that's why we haven't got one. What if he's making an absolute statement, not a comparison? Then the whole conclusion to the first sermon not only changes, but makes stunning biblical sense. He gets to the end of all of these said in chapters 1 and 2, and some of you are scratching your heads thinking, what on earth is he saying? Especially if you weren't here last week. Or maybe even if you were here last week. And then we get, there is nothing inherently good in a person to enable one to eat, drink, and cause one's soul to see good in one's labour. Even this, I realised, was from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat and who can find enjoyment? For to the person who's pleasing before him, this is similar anyway, God gives wisdom, knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he gives the task of gathering and amassing things only to give to the one who's pleasing in God's sight. This too is a vanity and vexation of spirit. If we could go back to the first part of that text, Trevor, thank you, and leave that up for the sermon. What I want to do this evening is start with the conclusion. Start with that and work through that, what Solomon's saying there, and then see how that impacts on the rest of the sermon and how it makes so much more sense. Solomon is saying that whilst there are all these fabulous things in the world, all these good gifts from God, And none of those gifts have been called evil by themselves or meaningless by themselves. Food. Just think about the variety of food that we've got. It's good. We don't have to live off of all bran and Brussels sprouts. I've just started my diet again, and there's still a great variety of things that I can eat. I can't eat donuts and butter and all those good things, but there's still so much that God gives. And drink, and work, and creativity, and culture, and relationships, and experiences. These are all things mentioned in chapters 1 and 2. None of those things are meaningless. None of those things are negative. But the problem is, apart from God, apart from going to the source of all good gifts, those things cannot satisfy us. What Solomon's saying there is that we do not have the ability in ourselves, inherently, independent of God, to find joy in those things. Not of the real, lasting kind. When you've thought about it, you're happy at the prospect there's no condemnation for you. It's bringing you joy already. There's a joy of being at peace with God. The joy of doing God's will. And walking with God. That's wonderful. That was Jesus' joy. Serving his Father. Honouring his Father. It's joy which is inexpressible, the New Testament says. Joy that isn't extinguished in the sadness and darkness of this world. A joy in God, which is able to enjoy life, not simply survive it or endure it. Joy in, is exactly what Solomon is saying here, enjoying everything God's given to us because we've got God. You, John, were telling me that you sang that hymn as a new Christian. Heaven above is brighter blue. Earth beneath is fairer green. And it meant something because you'd got God. And I can identify with that. Everything became new and enjoyable because we were in a relationship with God. What Solomon had worked for such a long time was exclusively to be found in God and received as the gift in Jesus Christ. As for the poor sinner, the end of the conclusion, the one who doesn't acknowledge God and trust him, God's given him a task as well. And it is a joyless and a futile one. It's a task of gathering up and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. And Solomon says that really is frustrating and perplexing for them. What do they make of that? That's true ultimately. No matter how much of the earth and its resources people own and secure, it's left to the meek who inherit the earth. Just had the new rich list published in the past week. The Hindujas right up the top, and Simon Cowell's made it in at £300 million, and Jamie Oliver flying the flag for the Olivers with his restaurants is right up there as well. And all these people, they own so much, they've amassed so much, and fewer people are gaining more and more and more of the earth's resources. And it all belongs to God. The earth and all of its fullness belong to the Lord, and he's given everything to his Son, Jesus Christ, whose pleasure is to divide it with his people. It will all be handed over to you and your brothers and sisters in Christ Jesus. And that isn't vanity. And it even happens sometimes in the short term. You younger children, there was this terrible dictator before you were born. He was a man called President Nicolae Ceausescu, and he ruled Romania with an iron fist. He was extremely wealthy, and yet his people lived in poverty, the majority of them in the second poorest country in Europe. Like many dictators, where wherever you went, there were great big statues of him built. Big bronze statues, so that nobody in Romania could escape the gaze or the presence of Nicolae Ceaușescu. And he was cruel to Christians. If we could transplant this place back into the 1970s into Romania, it would be quite likely that a bulldozer would come through the wall, that he knocked down their churches. And he threw one after another Christians into prison. Every day, my dad and mum in family prayers were praying for a man called Joseph Ton. Didn't know about him. Well, I knew about him. I'd never met him. I did meet him one day. And he'd been put in prison. Then he was out of prison and we thanked God. And then the next week he was back in prison. And he was in prison for a year maybe. He spent as much time in prison as the Apostle Paul. And then, one day, Ceaușescu fell. Was toppled from his throne. The people all rose up against him. And they pulled down those great big statues that he'd built all over Romania as a testament to his presence and his power. And they melted them down. And do you know what they turned them into? Church bells. Isn't that what Solomon's saying here? God has a lovely sense of irony. All that power, all of that wealth, all of that pride, all of that Ceaușescu saying, me, this is what I've got. And God says, okay, hand it over to the churches, they need new bells. But God doesn't just have a sense of irony, he has a heart of love as well. And he says to people, why? Why do you labour for what won't satisfy you? Why do you pour out your resources for not, what is not real? Why don't you come to me in faith? And these things that you need, I give to you freely in Christ Jesus. You can see why Solomon's come to this conclusion. Throughout the sermon up till now, he's been doing it without God. And it's so frustrating for him. I just again quickly go over the sermon. Verses 1 to 11, the problem rises in Solomon's mind. He looks at the sheer reliability and stability of nature. And that statement, big passage in verses 4, 5 onwards, is sandwiched between two texts about the transience of man in verse 4 and verses 10 and 11. The earth goes on relentlessly doing its thing, sun rising and setting and coming up the next day and then setting and then it's there again tomorrow. The rivers emptying into the sea yet never overflowing, going back to where they started from, the winds returning to where they started from. Nature does its thing very well. And yet we, who've got eternity in our hearts, who are made for something bigger, we just come and go. And yet, we're the ones crowned with glory and honour. We're the rulers over creation, aren't we? And yet, one generation comes, and one generation goes, and all is soon forgotten. I wondered about verse 10, whether Solomon had got that right, whether there is anything new that we can think of that hasn't been thought of before. And I had quite a long debate with him at this point in my mind. Maybe he's thinking of social, political and economic fields. And whatever new ideas we come up with today, they have actually mostly been thought of before, if not all. Big buzzword in economics for the past year or so has been quantitative easing. Printing more money and hosing it into the economy. They did that in the 1930s in Germany. I hope our quantitative easing has been a little bit more successful than theirs and doesn't have the same consequences. What about inventions? I came up with a microwave oven. Surely that was new, wasn't it? But then people have been cooking since time immemorial. And the microwave simply does cooking faster and probably not quite as well as they used to cook in the past. travel. We can travel further, but people have always travelled, even if it was walking. Computers, they've got to be new. Nobody's thought of them before. And then I realised that the Sumerian culture had abacuses, and they were doing that thousands of years before Christ. What about artificial intelligence? Well, what about real intelligence? Somebody invented that in Genesis chapter 1, and he's called God, and the real thing is much better than the artificial thing. Maybe there isn't anything new under the sun. I thought of that cartoon where a little boy's talking to his dad, and his dad says, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And the little boy says, "An inventor." He says, "What are you going to invent?" "I'm going to invent the wheel." And he says, "But it's already been invented." "But not for a long time, it hasn't." Well, there is nothing new under the sun. And the point here is that we fly by and we're gone, yet nature grinds relentlessly on. So Solomon has reached out from here, and he's embarked on this serious seeking of the meaning of life through wisdom. And he shows how serious he is, because he doesn't start in the red light districts of Babylon or the casinos of Tyre. He starts in his study. This is a serious quest. But however much knowledge he gains, however much insight he has, verse 15, he says, "What is crooked can't be made straight, and what is lacking can't be counted." I think he's saying there are problems in this world that are simply too big for fallen humans to solve. We cannot straighten out the problems of this world. We cannot solve it by ourselves. We cannot create utopia. However many books people write about it, we don't get there. We can't create perfectly fair societies. We can't have a legal system which is foolproof. We just don't have those things. We haven't got the ability by ourselves to create them. We can't eradicate disease. We can't defeat death. And the wiser and wiser that Solomon becomes, the more frustrated he gets, because he sees he's so far off of where he wants to be. So he turns to pleasure. But it too was temporary and futile. Chapter 2, verse 1, does alcohol then bring pleasure? He goes to wine. People believe it does, because we've got a serious drinking problem in our culture. Maybe they think we're not drinking enough, so they drink more and more, and it makes them more than merry, and it helps them forget. But when they come round again, the problems of this world haven't gone away, and the problems of their lives haven't gone away. They've actually got worse. So Solomon goes into construction and the horticulture business. He's busy building palaces and gardens. He's designing irrigation systems. One of our lunchtime treats in the Oliver household, during term time anyway, when the children are away, is that we sit down and we watch Bargain Hunt. We live an exciting life. And what happens in the middle of that program is that Tim Wonnicott, the presenter, will visit some stately home in the country, and he'll give you a bit of history about this place. There are all these amazing houses. He'll tell you who designed it, and then when it was redesigned, and what this owner put into it, and who built this part of it. And then you go out into the gardens and you see how beautifully they've been laid out. And then wonderful collections that have been gathered from Japan or India and brought together by this person who poured their life into this house. And then outside, here's the family mausoleum. I wonder if they got to the end of their lives before they were put into the mausoleum and thought, what was all that about? Because that's where Solomon was getting to. Is that what I've accomplished? Chapter 2, verse 3, "In my few days of life and labour under heaven, 5 minutes on Bargain Hunt in daytime TV." That doesn't satisfy Solomon. It's good work that he's doing, but it's not enough. He gets people to do his work, slaves. He goes into the livestock business. He gathers up wealth. We saw last week that he had, using the gold that we read about in the Bible, an income each year of $100 million. That's his disposable income. He'd make the Hindujas look poor. His assets, I don't know what they were, billions and billions. But wealth doesn't satisfy him. He went into culture, he got choirs together, he sponsored them, he gathered them, the finest voices. One wife wasn't enough for him. He tried loads of mistresses, he thought maybe sex was the answer. He got all the best looking women he could find. He talks about the delight of the children of men. He's utterly empty. Stuart Olliott says the pursuit of pleasure did not mean that he turned his back on the use of his intellect. Verse 9b. But even a combination of keys, pleasure and wisdom, could not unlock the meaning of life and give ending satisfaction. None of his experiences could rid him of the conviction that all of his quests were a waste of time, resulting in no lasting gain. The paths of intellect and pleasure had not taken him off the path of futility. He's struck by the awful truth that no matter how wise you are, the same event, death, overtakes you as it does the fool, and they all get forgotten in the end. And then he's struck by the fact that all of his hard work gets left behind. He doesn't take anything with him. What was Solomon worth when he died? Probably billions. How much did he leave? All of it. The poor Egyptian kings, they just were so sad about the thought of this, they had their treasures buried with them. Did a lot of good, didn't it? They're all in our museums now. Passed on to someone else, they couldn't take it with them. Then Solomon thinks, and what if the person who comes after me, who gathers all the fruit of my labour, doesn't really appreciate it and wastes it? It's all vanished. Poor, poor Solomon. His days were filled with sorrow. He ended up losing his sleep and saying, what's the point? And then it came to him. We were made by God. We were made for God. And we were made to enjoy God. And if God is missing, we've got nothing. And God's plan, God's blessing, is that we cannot find satisfaction apart from him. So that we seek him and we find him. And we can tell Solomon more about the gospel than he knew. We could say the answer to life is found in Jesus Christ, in trusting him. It's found in coming into a relationship with this loving God who doesn't just give us things to enjoy, he gives us himself to enjoy. And he loves us so much that he wants to spend eternity with us. Will you stop trying to find everything apart from God and turn in faith and repentance to God and trust God? Because apart from God, you've got nothing. But with God, you've got everything. May God bless his word. Strike our hearts as we're struggling with these things. But just encourage us that he's this God who doesn't just give good things. He gives himself. And may every one of us, if we've not found him, don't give up seeking till we do.